Jason here from the Fretboard Journal. If you are listening to this between January 24th and 27th, 2019, the Fretboard Journal is on the road. We are going to be down at the annual NAMM trade show in Anaheim, California. You can follow us on Instagram to see all of our real-time updates on what we are seeing, what we are loving, what we are laughing at. You can follow us on Instagram at Fretboard Journal. Or if you're not on Instagram, you can still see our page and see what we are up to by just going to Instagram.com/fretboardjournal. Wish us luck. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhouse playing in the background. Today, we are talking to the amazing instrumental guitarist, William Tyler. And I say the word we because I'm not doing the interview this week. Ryan Richter, former Fretboard Journal employee, still great friend to the Fretboard Journal and now man about town down in Southern California, did this interview for us. I hope you enjoy it. They cover a lot of ground. William is such an interesting guitarist. Many of you know him as being one of the American primitive style guitarists, sort of influenced by Fahey, but he also has sort of a country side. He also professes his love for the music of Michael Hedges during this interview, and they cover a lot of ground. I have to say, William Tyler has a new record out this week called Goes West. It's on Merge Records, and it is incredible. I have been listening to it a ton, so by all means, check that out. I think you will like it. If you are a Fretboard Journal fan, you probably are a Bill Frisell fan as well, and Bill is on this record, among others. So check it out. You will like it. Again, it's William Tyler's Goes West on Merge Records. I just want to give a quick plug to one of the other podcasts we're doing right now. The third episode of our Truth About Vintage Amps with Skip Simmons is up. I am the, I guess, straight man on that podcast. Skip answers all of your questions about amplification. He just called me the Ed McMahon of the show, which I'm not sure how I feel about. I'm not ready to buy tall, thin socks just yet and don those, but I guess I'm the Ed McMahon of the show. Check that out. It's on iTunes, it's on Stitcher, it's on Spotify. And even if you don't think you love vintage amps or care about listening to a podcast about them, Skip's a hoot. You will enjoy it. The Truth About Vintage Amps with Skip Simmons. We are going to be down at the NAMM show, as I mentioned earlier. Check us out on Instagram. We'll probably also be posting on Facebook some updates as well. And if you love what we are about, if you love what we're doing, if you love all these interviews and want to get even more of them and get even more Fretboard Journals in your life, consider the Fretboard Journal Insider program. You can read about it at fretboardjournal.com/insider. We have some cool industry discounts as well as some cool behind-the-scenes footage to share with just insiders. And the Fretboard Journal 43 is en route to all subscribers right now. So if you have not subscribed yet, this is the perfect time to get it. I'm looking at a palette full of magazines that I would love to share with all of you guys. Billy Strings, the amazing flat picker, is on the cover. But we're not talking about flat picking. We're talking about the guitar his grandfather built in prison and the restoration process that Billy and Dave Johnson did to restore that thing. It is an amazing tale, as well as we've got stories on Billy's roommate, Molly Tuttle, and Rory Hoffman from Nashville as well. Tim Easton is in this issue, as well as George Loudon from Ireland. So if you are at all into amazing guitar stories, check out the Fretboard Journal 43. Again, you can subscribe to it at fretboardjournal.com. All right, here is our interview with William Tyler. I hope you enjoy it.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're here with William Tyler.
What's up, y'all?
What do we got here? We got January 2nd, 2019. Beautiful, sunny Los Angeles. It's, I don't know where you all are, but it's nice. It's, some would say, cold, characteristically.
It's California cold.
It's California cold.
Which is deceptive.
It is deceptive. It is deceptive, dude.
It gets really cold.
It gets really cold here.
No, it really gets cold.
Last night in my house where we're insulated with essentially nothing, it was it could have been black ice, is all I'm saying. But yeah, man, you just came back from doing the holiday in Nashville?
Did the holiday thing in Nashville with the family, which was nice to get back. I'm sure it's kind of the same here. So it's essentially is a city of transplants, you know, ratio-wise to natives. And so when the holidays happen, it's kind of like everybody jokes about, like, oh, it's like the traffic is like what it used to be like before everybody moved here. and everything kind of shuts down. Probably similar to what happens here around Christmas and New Year's, because everybody goes home. But it was good to be back.
Nice. So, did you see any music while you were there?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, when I mean, you know, was trying to kind of do the tour guide thing, because my girlfriend came with me and she'd never been to Nashville before, so we went to the honky tonks. There's a honky tonk down on Lower Broadway called Roberts, which is pretty legendary, and that's sort of the spot on Christmas night that everybody goes to because it's one of the only bars that's open.
Yeah,
so that's a pretty cool place.
Great.
But yeah, you know, Nashville has no lack of, you know, ripping live country music.
Sure.
It's kind of amazing. It's like what people go for.
Sure. You know? Well, cool, man. We're here to talk about a few things, but we're here primarily to talk about your new record, which is called Goes West.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to let you kind of like take the reins in terms of telling me how songs came to be or how you chose the personnel or worked with Tucker, the producer.
Well, you know, the genesis of this record, I mean, essentially came about because I wanted to move back to a more acoustic focused record. It's when I was touring, when my last album Modern Country came out, I didn't do so much band touring just because of logistics. It was and even then it was like the band was usually different. Which is fine because I've kind of gotten to a point now where like I can teach everybody my songs, I can chart everything out, I can sort of put an ensemble together for a specific show, and it's not, you know, it's not crazy, but it's also not, I haven't found a way of doing a full band tour, so to speak, that feels appropriate or like, you know, feasible financially even. So, you know, a lot of it is still like me playing solo. And I just kind of was gravitating back towards the acoustic guitar, you know, and a lot of about half the songs on this new record were written before I left Nashville, like in the last year. And then about half of them were written after I moved out here. And it's just got more of an introspective, to me, feel to it. A little more intimate because it's acoustic driven. I feel like a lot of the songs on Modern Country are more like themes that suit themselves to an openness, especially with a full band and primarily being an electric guitar record.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I approached kind of grouping the songs together for this album they're more like, to me, they feel more like really fully realized compositions.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, I was pulling from like piano influences, like Debussy pieces, and you know, I don't know, like also had been revisiting a lot of kind of the Windham Hill acoustic stuff, you know, the early Alex DeGrassi, Michael Hedges, and William Ackerman stuff.
I was gonna say
that was a pretty big influence on it, sonically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And as a person who, like, we've talked about this in the past, like, you and I share a love of that catalog.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, as a listener and someone who's familiar with your stuff, it's the first time that I was able to say to myself, like, oh, these are even some of the recording. I don't know if it was as deliberate as saying, here's what this Michael Hedges record sounds like. I've always loved it.
Sure.
Let's try to bring that into this recording a little bit. Because I could hear compositionally, playing wise, or even just the recording sensibility of some of the songs, like, I was hearing that stuff, which I love.
Cool.
Because
he's
the man.
I agree. And it's an interesting journey that I've had even, and I think a lot of players have had, through kind of rediscovering the solo guitar world. And, you know, you there's a tendency with people to, especially the way I came up through it, where you sort of come about in a back doorway to John Fahey.
Mm-hmm.
And the Tacoma stuff. And for me personally, when I was in my early 20s and started getting interested in that music and started kind of slowly learning how to finger pick, you know, it was kind of the thing where it's like, oh, if you like krautrock and Sonic Youth and, you know, free jazz, you'll like John Fahey and Robbie Basho and Sandy Bull. And it was kind of like, it was like, quote, weird music, you know. And then just the deeper for me that I got into it and frankly, like, learned how to be a better guitar player, it's like, then you start being like, oh, well, there's also Leo Kaki, and that's a little more, maybe that's more traditional, even though he started out on Tacoma. And then same thing with William Ackerman and Alex Degrassi and Michael Hedges. And you just start, for me, it's like, I mean, I know there's like a, there's a, there is a tendency among certain people in my world even to sort of look, I don't want to say look down on, but like, you know, there's just some aesthetic choices in the production of some of those records and the playing that I think like turns some people off that are maybe into the more, the, you know, like I said, the weirder stuff. And I mean, there is certainly a conscious choice about the way somebody like Fahey made records and the way somebody like Michael Hedges made records, but they've really all kind of started it from the same sources, and essentially it's still acoustic guitar music.
Yeah.
And I see it as part of a continuum the same way, like, you know, I appreciate Miles Davis's catalog from the 50s to the 80s, and same thing, like, some people have a hard time with like the stuff he did in the 80s or the, even the stuff he did in the 70s, but it's like, to him it made sense, it was continuum. And Fahey was the same way, you know, like, they never repeated themselves, essentially. So, you know, that was all on my mind. I mean, when I started doing this stuff publicly, I guess, I was very self-conscious of the fact that you get branded with, you know, the shadow of Fahey and Tacoma and all of that is especially even 10 years ago, like, was a little more, I mean, it's definitely a resurgence of that kind of music at an independent level. And I mean, those are pretty heavy footsteps to be following in. And it's kind of like, I probably felt the urge to run away from the giants of acoustic guitar from time to time, because I wanted people to look at what I was doing as more just like instrumental music rather than specifically, you know, Tacoma / and Windham Hill even influenced acoustic music. But I also am pretty literal about my influences, and I think it's good to honor those. And so, yeah, there was a conscious decision, I think, to chase some of those sounds on this record.
Yeah,
for sure.
I'm like I said, I'm glad you did. Yeah, those are some of my favorite sounds. And working with Tucker Martine, are you able to say like aerial boundaries, and he latches on just like, yep, I know exactly what to do?
Tucker is a really interesting, I mean, I really feel like there was a lot of good synchronicities that worked out there. So Tucker is from Nashville. He grew up in Nashville. He's older than me. He's probably about 10 years older. But his parents and my parents were really good friends early on. Like, they were all songwriters. And so I sort of grew up knowing who he was, because I used to work at this coffee house that his dad came in almost every day. And then I just started seeing his name on records, on like everything from like Sublime Frequencies field recordings to, you know, Frizzell stuff and My Morning Jacket and just whatever. He just has this pretty incredible like discography of stuff he's worked on. And I was always interested in, like, I felt like he probably was spiritually, there was some kinship there. We just never actually met or worked together. Mm. And so I just made a connection with him. I just kind of reached out on the internet and was like, hey, you know, like, I know we know each other, we have mutual friends, you know, would you potentially be interested in working together? And he was really into the idea. And then Brad Cook, who's the other producer on the record and plays bass, we had been trying to put together a time and a place for this to happen, which shifted a few times, you know. But when he kind of, when Tucker sort of became the anchor of it, it was, that's when we sort of filled in the band. And Griffin Goldsmith from Dawes plays drums on it, and Meg Duffy, who's plays under the name Hand Habits, plays all the electric, and then our buddy James Wass, who's a North Carolina guy, does all the keys. And yeah, I guess I sent out some sort of like short notes about things for people to reference, like, honestly, the first Penguin Cafe Orchestra record. Mm. You know, and like, I'm interested in kind of that whole world of that sort of semi-Eno world. You know, there's like Harold Budd and like I mean, a lot of it kind of does sort of cross over into the New Age Wyndham Hill stuff, too. There's kind of an interesting universe of sonic stuff there that kind of lives in a place. But, I sort of, like, reached out to everybody. I was like, okay, here's kind of what I'm thinking, mm-hmm. you know, but don't get too precious about, you know, these reference points, because I want you guys to bring, you know, what you're hearing to the project.
Sure. Cool. Something I also wonder about is that as a fan and appreciator of Modern Country, your last record, honestly, something I think that you do so well and that kind of stands alone from the record is the really well-considered, really, I don't know, well-composed EPK video that you made.
Oh, yeah.
Which seems like its own standalone kind of thesis statement on that record and obviously yeah. where America was at the time for you, which is, that goes without saying, or I guess it wouldn't take much for someone to drill down and make that assumption. My question being, did you have a kind of emotive thesis statement or a narrative about this record?
Well, I mean, you know, I guess the short answer would be no, but the longer explanation would be that I wanted there to be a thematic unity to this record that I think it has because it was cut with a specific group of people and the songs kind of live together in a certain way. But there wasn't like a philosophical conceit behind it the way there was with Modern Country or even Impossible Truth, which was the record before that I did. And part of that was just like, you know, like, I felt like I sort of said what I needed to say about that with Modern Country, because that whole record's concept essentially was about this sort of weird, I don't want to say forgotten America, but definitely like something about America that felt bittersweet and left behind and not really spoken about in mainstream culture. And it wasn't necessarily about the election, but I feel like a lot of what I was getting at kind of happened in the election, you know, like, not that it's about rural America, notice, so to speak, but although it kind of is, because it's a driving record that was largely inspired by driving through rural America, yeah. you know, on tour, so to speak. But there's sort of a sadness about that record, I sense, that's about, like, the last song's called The Great Unwind. And it's like, it's kind of like, I don't want to say it's about the death of the American dream, but it's kind of a funeral ode to something mm-hmm. that I feel like, but it came out before the election. And then when the election happened, I was like, oh, well, I mean, this doesn't surprise me. This is actually, I thought that historically our country was going to take this really sharp turn that unfortunately, you know, tragically is what happened. But, you know, like the title goes west. Was actually the idea of my friend Mike Taylor, who is His Gold Messenger. And, you know, at first I was like, well, that's so literal. Like, it's like, because I moved to California a couple of years ago. I was like, well, I mean, you know. But then I started thinking about it. I was like, actually, no, I that's perfect. Because, like, I really wanted something direct. And I also, like, my first idea for the title had been Forever West. And that was already taken. I think that actually might be a Kanye track. So
can't do that.
Can't do that. But I wanted to evoke something about the West. Mm-hmm. Because there's something, you know, like I had a conversation about this last week with an interviewer. And they were, you know, talking about the phrase, go West, young man. And, you know, like what that means in American history. And I was like, well, what I'm trying to do with this title, or at least the concept behind the title, is like, divorce that from the imperialist, colonialist...
Land-grabby.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, that's... You know, I'm, like, obsessed with history and American history, and, you know, like, I don't think there's any need to romanticize... You know, we've spent hundreds of years romanticizing this mythical thing about the history of the West, which just... You know, I feel like thankfully now, and at least in cinema, we're kind of beginning to untangle. You know, but like it's not a narrative that where there's much to be romanticizing. You know, yeah. But the concept of going west, as I call it, kind of like chasing the sunset, you know, there is something that I think in modern America we can look at as like, you know, maybe there's this kind of hopefulness. I mean, as a Southerner, I will say that, you know, coming out here, there's a hopefulness.
You can hear it.
You know?
You can hear it in the record.
Yeah,
I think so. It's optimistic.
It's optimistic. Yeah. And it's optimistic, you know, and it's, you know, like most of my songs are come out of a mixture of sadness and whatever, but, you know, moving out here when I did, which was basically right after the election, I definitely, like, noticed things that, like I said, there's a kind of optimism about just, it's this being out here that's, it's just more progressive. I mean, it's progressive. It's like that alone, there's little things that I think if you live in the South your whole life, you know, even if you're as insulated as I am, as like a, you know, upper middle class white dude, you know, like you don't, it's still shocking how California specifically feels like a completely different country.
Sure.
Than, I mean, let alone Tennessee, but even somewhere like Wisconsin, you're just like, oh, wow, yeah, this is actually, you know. And so, you know, that's reflected in the record, and I think, yeah, I think there's still, I'm still trying to find some hope in what's going on in our country, I would say.
Yeah. You
know? And so if that's reflected at all in the title, that's probably where it's coming from, but I don't know if there's like a larger kind of narrative to like the way the songs fit together. They're pretty personal songs.
So. Sure. Well, I mean, yeah, it's for me, self-imposing my own, you know, batch of meanings onto it. That's just where I was at. I was kind of like digesting it and thinking, sure. Oh, this is actually a pretty, you know, reflective, optimistic, hopeful thing, which is, I guess, what we want in terms of being on the other side of in a traumatic election to some people.
Yeah, and also I think it gets into the territory of like what role, and I mean this is something I really do struggle with just as a conscious artist who's younger, you know, like you're dealing with this thing of like you're trying to do your thing and like maintain your career and grow it hopefully, but you're also like aware, or you should be, that what we live in this time of like crisis, and it's like it's a privilege to get to do any of this. Mm-hmm. But it's like, if you don't realize, especially if you're a white dude with a guitar, how your privilege and your, you know, entitlement has gotten you to a point that like a lot of people just don't get to, like you need to be able to speak to like the uniqueness of that and not like, you know, not just assume that like, oh, well, things have been this way forever, so they're going to keep being this way. It's like, I think about that a lot because the music, you know, my music's instrumental. It's like, I don't know if there's, you know, I'd like to think that there's some sort of like meditative kind of, I don't want to say healing, but like, you know, like that it serves a purpose.
Yeah.
Which is probably what has attracted me more and more to like new age, quote, new age stuff. It's like, yeah, this is like, or ambient music. It's like, no, this music is actually supposed to, it's okay if it's background music that you do yoga to or whatever. It's like the whole point of it is like, it opens up a headspace for you that maybe, you know, is an antidote to the kind of anxiety we have and like depression and, you know, the things I struggle with as a writer too. But I mean, hopefully the music is like I said, is kind of an antithesis to that.
Yeah. Well, this one, you know, again, from my stance, it's it has all that on offer, but it also has a real easy to latch onto. I don't want to say pop sensibility, but I do mean that in terms of like in other records that you have, like you have an opening stanza of a song that's very kind of expansive and sets the stage. These songs have that too, but they got me more to kind of like the across second base a little faster.
Sure.
Where I'm identifying choruses or whatever it is.
Sure.
Just structure stuff. And it's really nice, man. I love it.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, a couple of them actually are quite a bit older. There's one, the first song on the record, which is called Alpine Star, is like, I started writing that around the same time that Modern Country came out. So like, but I just knew like this song doesn't work on this record. Oh. It's too, I don't want to say symphonic, but it's, there's too many major minor shifts and too much movement, and it just feels like its own thing. It doesn't belong on this record.
Sure.
That's why I was kind of just trying to make space on this album for like those kind of compositions. So, yeah. But, no, I agree, and I'm glad you hear that.
Now, what's next? Are you going to be doing some touring, I assume?
I'm going to start touring on and off the rest of the year. My first leg is coming up in mid-February to mid-March, mostly East Coast stuff.
Cool. By yourself?
Yeah.
Okay. And, like, truly by yourself or in support?
Truly solo. I mean, there'll definitely be opportunities to have full band shows, you know, in bigger cities. Hopefully we'll do a band show out here in L.A., probably one in Nashville, but they're just going to have to be scattered in between solo stuff, because that's still kind of essentially the only way I really know how to tour.
Yeah. So. Light and easy.
Light and easy.
Easier.
I've got a Camry hybrid. It's about 38 miles a gallon.
That's what you need.
Fits a lot of trunk space, you know.
Yeah, that's important stuff. Now, let's talk gear for a second.
Yeah.
When you go out on the road, I'm looking at a guitar. Is this going to be what you bring with
the
you?
Martin?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an 18. This was my uncle's, who sadly passed away last year. But he gave this to me about 10 years ago. And I had a luthier rework the neck, because this is a pre-truss rod Martin. Mm. It's a 50s Martin. This has been my main touring acoustic for the last 6 or 7 years. I usually go out with an electric as well, like a Tele. You know, and I have a simple pedal setup, you know, but I do a lot of looping and stuff live, and so I usually have an electric acoustic mix, you know, just to have it varied. That's mostly it. I mean, I have the probably the coolest guitar I have, honestly, in terms of its uniqueness, is a Jerry Jones 12 string.
Oh, wow.
Which, just one of those small world things. He went to high school with my mom in Jackson, Mississippi, and they've known each other forever. And when I was a teenager, he kind of like let me sort of pick out a body type, like a double cutaway, you know, like one of the kind of double cutaway Dan Electro bodies, and like a mustard yellow. And that wasn't like one he made, you know? So it's like kind of a one of a kind electric. And I use that quite a bit in live shows, just because I just think 12 string, I mean, 12 string acoustic is amazing, obviously, but like 12 string electric, I think, is a pretty underutilized solo instrument.
Yeah.
There's so much depth to it, and it's not, I think people associate it with a certain kind of music, understandably, but it's a pretty cosmic instrument on its own. You know, you can get a lot of like overtones that are almost harp or piano like that you just can't get on a six string. Mm-hmm. So I usually tour with that as well.
Cool.
I've got that in the mix.
Nice, man. I think this is the only acoustic I've seen you with. Is this your only?
I have a Gibson B25 that was also an heirloom guitar. It was my father's. I don't tour with that as much, but yeah. Just because it's even a little more precious, I would say, in terms of like, it was the guitar I grew up with him playing, and sort of being like, don't touch this guitar. Sure. You know, like, this is my guitar. And then when I turned 22, he just kind of gave it to me out of nowhere, kind of like passed it on. And I'm like, whoa, you know. And I record with it a fair amount, but I don't usually tour with it.
Yeah, I understand that. I have a few of those guitars.
We all do.
Yeah.
I would love to be able to not tour with this one, because frankly, this one's pretty precious to me at this point. But it's like, you know, it's, as you know, it's kind of like a person or something. You just becomes an extension of yourself, especially the acoustic instruments, and there's just a way, you know, it's going to sound, and there's an energy to it that just is familiar, and you just know how it speaks.
Yeah, I understand. I can dig it. Do you want to play something?
Sure.
Yeah, might as well. I mean,
yeah. Do you have a
preference? Whatever's in that tuning, you don't I don't know. I can't ID the tuning that well.
Oh, well, I'll change the tuning for it. But yeah, maybe I'll do one. I'm going to do this one called Call Me When I'm Breathing Again.
Thank you.
Tell me about the tuning.
So this is a C tuning. It's just, this is C major with an F in it. So it's C, F, C, G, C, E.
Okay.
So it's a cool tuning because it's pretty easy to go back and forth between C and F key wise.
What, and do you find that you write in a batch of a few?
I mean, I probably gravitate towards, I think like a lot of guys who were trained on Fahey and Leo Kottke, it's pretty easy to get stuck in C major zone.
Yeah.
There's something really satisfying about having the major third on top, and having it tuned down that low is great for the bass. That's definitely like the one I feel probably the most comfortable around. But I don't, you know, like I'm trying to more and more like be a little more inventive about tunings, even if it's just like one string differential than something that's like a fairly traditional tuning. I have this one that's D A D A A E.
Mm.
And another one that's D A D G A E.
Mm.
So there's kind of, you know, like, yeah, so it's like, I don't know, there's something like, oh, here's a dadgad or a C major, and, you know, you have a variant one string differential thing that's like, or a G major with it tuned down, with the B string tuned down to A.
Sure.
You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's a pretty fascinating process when you're arranging the songs for other instruments. Which is something I've found is one of the more fulfilling parts of the compositional process for me, is trying to, you know, map it out for, you know, other stringed instruments or piano or, you know, just other... There's so many different, like, ways you can voice the chord to where it could be one thing or another thing. And I'm like, well, it's just this. And, not, you know, I'm like, well, let's see what notes are in this. I guess this is kind of like an A flat major 7 chord, but it could be this. You know, like,
sure.
Yeah, alternate tunings are kind of amazing for that. I'm pretty fascinated with them. It's a tricky thing though when you're like playing with like one guitar live. I definitely like have to logistically structure my sets around detuning and uptuning.
Of course.
You know, so it's like probably either like I would either start a set detuned all the way down to C.
And slowly migrate.
Or vice versa.
Right.
You know, go from standard down.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, every time you change a note, or I mean a string, I mean, it changes the mathematics of the fretboard, essentially makes it a different instrument.
Yeah.
You gotta learn every time again.
Totally. Whole new world. Shifting just a little bit, what are you listening to these days?
What am I listening to?
I mean, potentially a terrible question, but...
No, it's not. I have to admit that since moving out here, I pretty much leave the radio in my car on KUSC, which actually is like a really useful... I mean, that's like, it's weird how like sometimes you'll hear a piece of classical music that's pretty familiar and it'll generate an idea, for me at least. So I listen to that a lot. In terms of like newer artists that I'm listening to, in terms of people who haven't been dead for 200 years.
Sure.
Let me think. Who am I listening to a lot these days? You know, I have to say I do tend to gravitate towards instrumental music. It's like it helps me focus in a different kind of way when I'm driving or reading, and like, I can get lost in melodies about as easily as I get lost in words. If anything, melodies are more distracting to me than the cadence of lyrics. And it's probably just because I don't think about lyrics anymore. I mean, I definitely appreciate them. I mean, like, you know, I was reading an interview with John Prine pretty recently, and he was talking about the lyrics process and how he had, like, a thesaurus and... like on his desk, and it's just like, oh, if that guy is still, I mean, he's maybe the greatest living songwriter, like if he's still, you know, using kind of like
academic tools, so to speak, to craft lyrics. And it's like, there's a part of me that's like, yeah, you should be approaching it that seriously. There's also a part of me that like understands that like not all great singers have to be saying anything necessarily. I mean, I like one of my favorite bands growing up and still is R.E.M. And you know, there's a whole lineage of great singers who you know, maybe wrote lyrics that were great, but sort of, I don't want to say nonsensical, but, you know, or like Cocteau Twins or something. It's like,
sure. That's my favorite.
It's my right. favorite. It's like, I don't know what they're saying. Maybe it's a made up language. It's really compelling though.
And ultimately, like most, in the case of the Cocteau Twins, like no less emotive.
Of course.
Like it's, you know, that's their thing, but it's like better that it doesn't make any sense.
No, and you know, it's, I would say another, like a modern example, that's Justin Vernon from Bon Iver. I mean, his lyrics are pretty obtuse, and a lot of times I don't, like, but they're very compelling because he is one of the most compelling singers alive. And I think that, yeah, it's an interesting thing, like what can steer a song, so to speak. I look at the melody, at the top line melody as being the singer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like, it's kind of like, somebody was asking me about this record because I don't play any electric parts. Meg Duffy does all the electric guitar. And some of that was like the economy of time. Like we tracked it in like 4 days. But a lot of it also was like, I was treating this guitar or the acoustic and, you know, as being the singer, you know, it's like, you don't need to like double track the singer necessarily. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, it's just, you put it forward. This is the guy who's delivering the melody. That's the statement of the song, essentially, and everything else is kind of like supporting it. And I'm interested in like how that's reflected in instrumental music, because I do find instrumental music to be really compelling, and I can sort of listen to I can definitely listen to stuff in an ambient way or in an active way, and I think that's like something that, you know, is kind of, I mean, in a way it's like I do truly believe in the power of instrumental music, because I think I feel like there should be a universality to it, because there's not a language barrier there. Yeah. You know, it's always fascinating to me that like how, like the last couple of times I had toured Europe, I would usually get paired with an opener that was like a singer-songwriter, and they would always sing in English, you know, no matter where you were, Italy, Spain, you know, places where you don't necessarily think of people really knowing the language, let alone singing in it. Mm. But what's fascinating to me about language as its own instrument, or as its own form of music, I would say, is that there's a musicality to every language, and people, you know, people just sing a certain thing and it sounds right in that language, you know, whether it's singing in English or, you know, if you're, you know, I listen to a lot of Brazilian music. I don't understand Portuguese, but there's obviously a music to that language that it just wouldn't be the same without it.
Yeah, you know? It would be seriously lacking if it was changed into English or adapted to any other language.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I will say, just, you know, because I think playing music without words and writing that way, you know, and not being formally trained, you know, I mean, I had a little bit of it, but like coming at it from a non-academic or non-classical angle, so to speak, and also growing up in Nashville, it's a pretty peculiar thing, because there's just this assumption, Nashville is such a singer-songwriter community, and I think there's just this assumption that you get up there with a guitar and you're supposed to sing, mm-hmm. you know, even if you don't really have anything to say, because it is about the singer and the word flow as much as it is the musicianship, I think, in a lot of cases. So I definitely grew up around songwriting in a way that made me really conscious of the process and appreciate it too. And I still do. I mean, I listen to a lot of country music as well. But yeah, it's interesting how it's just the further along I go, the less influenced by lyrics I feel like I am. I don't have an urge to put words to songs anymore. I think when I started writing instrumental pieces, they weren't necessarily supposed to be that. They were just like, I just didn't have words for them yet. And then gradually I just kind of decided that maybe a lot of these pieces work as their own themes. They don't need the cadence of lyrics to guide them, you know.
Yeah. I can dig it.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me, man. I really enjoyed it.
Anything else that we're glossing over?
Anything else we're
glossing over? I'm sure there's like entire universes of stuff that we're
glossing over. You know, I feel good having this conversation the second day of the year because it makes me think that there's going to be a lot more to talk about a year from now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm hopeful, you know, as I think a lot of us, we all get reflective this time of year because it's the beginning of one.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm definitely hopeful. And like I said, I think there's always a constant mixture of sadness and hopefulness in my music. And I think, you know, the optimism of this album that I think you picked up on, you know, hopefully others will as well, because I believe there's definitely things to be hopeful for.
Yeah, it's a fact. When does it come out, by the way?
It comes out January 25th.
Great.
Yeah.
We'll do things again.
Thanks, man.
Cheers.
Cheers.